Well, thank you very much for this very kind introduction. I'm very happy to be here in Columbus, Ohio. Yesterday I had a moment of doubt, which is a very religious thing, because there was so much snow everywhere in the U.S. So I'm happy that I can make it and can talk a little bit about my recent work, which has been basically leading a research project at the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen on a comparative study of Bombay, Singapore, Shanghai, and Seoul. This is work done by a... That's a very urban sound. By a team of scholars, some based in my institute in Göttingen, some based in universities around the world, and working together with us on this topic. This comparative work is about the location of religion in Asian cities, and I have just finished a handbook on this topic, which will be published by the University of California Press in the summer. It was a kind of massive volume of 450 pages on these the various aspects of religion in Asian cities. So I will be talking about partly my own work and partly other people's work on this on the topic. It is a talk about urban aspirations in Asia. Neither urban nor aspirations is self-evident, and these terms therefore require some discussion. Defining the urban would seem to require inventing its opposite, the rural. The rural urban-urban divide is one of the traditional pieties of the social sciences. Like most dichotomies, it hides more than it clarifies. Certainly there are important differences in scale between villages and cities, such as there are such differences between megacities and provincial towns. I live in a very provincial town, a small German town called Göttingen. A very different kind of feel to it than Shanghai or Bombay, you can imagine that. These scale differences have significant implications for governance, housing, land ownership, and industrial relations. Surely, scale matters. However, the rural-urban divide should not be taken as a metaphor for a whole series of dichotomies, such as mechanical versus organic solidarity in Durkheim's work, Gemeinschaft versus Gesellschaft in Tunney's work, or little traditions versus great traditions in Redfield's work. To an extent, such dichotomies of modernization have been taken to another level in globalization theories, as in the opposition of the global city versus the nation state, in for instance, Saskia Sassen's work. Anthropologists of India and Indonesia realized already in the 1980s that the village community, their primary ethnographic object, was largely a construction of colonial governmentality. Similarly, we need to interrogate our notions of urban society in order to understand the different trajectories of urbanization and social formation in human society, as well as their insertion in forms of governmentality. In fact, it is hard to draw a sharp boundary between city and village. For instance, work on urban villages in China shows that spatially urban expansion is encroaching on village land, and that differentiated village rights continue to play a role in these cities, with important social consequences for the relation between established and outsiders. Say, the work by Helen Xu, for example, on Hong Kong, shows that these urban villages are still very important, and by Woody Watson on the Man lineage, people who own the restaurants, the Chinese restaurants in Holland and in Britain, basically still have village rights in Hong Kong, which are very important. This is a multi-million dollar right. In other places like Singapore, city planning has demolished the previous kampungs, leaving in its wake a politics of heritage. Again, in Thailand, one finds that the imagined and real urban-rural divide between Bangkok and the rest has enormous political consequences. More generally, one probably needs to speak about city regions like Shanghai Suzhou, or Hangzhou Ningbo, or the Mumbai Pune corridor. These are cities, basically, if you travel now from Shanghai to Suzhou, it's very hard to see what's the end of Shanghai and what is the beginning of Suzhou. One needs to speak about these things to account for the continuous interactions that cross the borders of the city. In all these senses, the limits of the city are porous and arbitrary. At the same time, in India and China and Thailand, one finds settlements in the city that create urban villages of immigrants and are intricate parts of the urban fabric. That's also the feel you have in a place like Bombay. When you go to Dharavi, for example, in Bombay, it's really a village feel that you have. Moreover, hometown associations are crucial elements in Chinese transnational networks of urban dwellers, creating substantial flows of information, finance, and people between, say, Chinatown in New York and Fuzhou district in South China. To buy a house in the village while actually living in the city is a feature of this interconnectivity. There are entire villages in Fujian that are empty, beautiful houses, but these people are not there. They are living in New York or maybe here in Columbus, Ohio. It's a feature of this interconnectivity that blurs in social terms any sharp distinction between city and village, or a big city, small city. So people are socially interconnected, although they sometimes live in the city and sometimes live somewhere else. This has become a defining element of the social landscape of Gujarat, Punjab, Kerala, Guangzhou, and Fujian. The opposition of the urban and the rural is reproduced to an extent in the opposition of the global and the local in the literature. Globalization is not the undoing of the local, just as urbanization is not the undoing of the local. They are complex transformations that produce new spatial formations. They are best seen as aspects of the production of locality. Well, in some cases one can speak about ethnic enclaves like Chinatown, Koreatown, Little India. This is not appropriate when one deals with the, for example, the transnational connections of a million or more Taiwanese businessmen and workers living and working in the Shanghai area, or of the embeddedness of Singapore in the Malay region. Especially when considering global financial markets, it is striking that the global city provides a necessary context for them, despite the increasing dependence on internet-enabled transactions that can, in principle, be executed from anywhere. In fact, as Saskia Sassen has demonstrated, these markets are important elements in the shaping of the urban context. Similarly, national and transnational migration, a distinction that I think is primarily made in terms of citizenship. One question one can ask is always, what is the difference between the migration to Bombay and the migration to some other place in Europe? The national and transnational migration is both flowing toward cities and transformed cities. Finally, media images produced in Bollywood, Hong Kong, Taipei, Shanghai, and Seoul provide imaginations of cities that are globally consumed, as well as provide the self-perceptions of local people in all these places and of those who desire to move here. I have a colleague at Princeton, Gyan Pandey, who is originally from Bihar, who has had his whole life this ambition to move to Bombay, because that's where Biharis want to go. And in the end, he has ended up there. In the past, Western cities like Berlin, London, Paris, and New York offered much material for the imagination of urban ambition. But today, Shanghai and Singapore provide a seemingly more future-oriented vision. While scale does distinguish big places from small ones, the question, as put succinctly by Arjuna Padurai, remains: what produces a locality in a world and where spatial localization, quotidian interaction, and social scale are not always isomorphic? Appadurai draws our attention to the ways in which localities are not given, but produced as structures of feeling within the context of political economy. Moreover, localities are not spatially bounded, but imaginatively and ritually understood in relation to other localities and to larger imagined communities like the nation or the dispersed diasporic ethnic community. So to understand what we understand as the urban, we have to pay more attention to imagination than simply to urban planning and the limits of the city. The extent to which communities are localized and in what ways is historically and contextually produced. Such an emphasis on imagination does not distract from the materialities of social life, but allows us to consider the material effects of social imagination. Worries about what constitutes the city are common among urban theorists. The dominant voices among urban theorists come from Marxist traditions that focus on the city as a crucial site of capital accumulation, and thus of particular importance in capitalist transformations, as well as a crucial site for class struggle. Such theory is closely related to urban activism, as in the recent Occupy Wall Street movement. However, what is true for Marxist theory in general, I think, also applies to Marxist urban studies. It's too focused on both economic transformation and resistance to be able to come to grips with the variety of urban aspirations that are not directly related to class or indeed the economy. The Marxist tradition is not a tradition that encourages ethnography of microprocesses, although it captures always some major elements of the larger picture. Nevertheless, also Marxist theorists seem to feel that there is something elusive in the urban that cannot be entirely understood by the study of capitalism. For instance, listen to this quote from probably the most important urbanist, the Marxist Lefebvre, in his The Urban Revolution, and I cite, and I quote, "The signs of the urban are signs of assembly. The things that promote assembly, streets, squares, spaces, surfaces, sidewalks, and buildings, and the requirements for assembly, seats, lights. The urban is most forcefully evoked by the constellation of lights at night, especially when flying over a city," which is indeed true. When I came flying to Columbus, it's really a very beautiful city when you fly into this city. "The dazzling impression of brilliance, neon, street signs, street lights, incitements of various kinds, the simultaneous accumulation of wealth and signs. The urban," he adds, "is pure form, a place of encounter, assembly, simultaneity. This form has no specific content, but is a center of attraction and life. It's an abstraction, but unlike a metaphysical entity, the urban is a concrete abstraction, associated with practice. Living creatures, the products of industry, technology, and wealth, works of culture, ways of living. Its contents, things, objects, people, situations are mutually exclusive because they are diverse, but inclusive because they are brought together and imply their mutual presence. The urban is both form and receptacle, void and plenitude, super object and non-object, super consciousness in the totality of consciousness." Unquote. It's clearly a very evocative text. And not immediately Marxist, but only Marxist in a certain way, cultural Marxist, as some people were saying about Lefebvre. Lefebvre's evocative text recalls those of Baudelaire, Benjamin, Simo, which seems to indicate that there is something elusive of the city that calls for more poetic accounts than materialism usually allows. Contemporary urban theorists who are inspired by Lefebvre go back to Spinoza, of course via Deleuze, for a metaphysics of the city. But despite this taste for pantheism, what remains outside of the picture are practical, everyday urban aspirations that connect to self-cultivation and self-presentation, which require a more anthropological approach. Besides urban, it is aspiration in urban aspirations that needs some reflection. Arjuna Padarai has used the concept of aspiration to point to the ideational character of many of the processes that affect cityscapes and urban movements. He focuses on the capacity to aspire as an orientation to the future, and writes to promote capacity building among the poor as part of developmental strategy. But the concept is more generally applicable to city planning, squatting, migration and gentrification, as well as to the extraordinary role played by religion, the media and creative arts in global cities. By paying attention to the aspirations of people, of communities, of classes, of experts and institutions, one can get away from the static connotations of the concept of identity that tends to fix people to what and where they are, rather than to what and where they aspire to be. A lot of work in say, anthropology of the city, in urban anthropology, is just about, say, the Turks in Berlin and, say, all these ethnic communities being placed and fixed in their Turkishness and Muslimness or whatever, instead of looking at what where these people want to be and what they want to be. The factorial potential of the concept of aspiration does not do away, however, with the analytical requirement to situate it within a field of unequal power. When aspirations cannot be achieved, people may feel a real sense of frustration and despair, which is as important in motivating people as aspiration. So both aspiration and despair are a couple that have to be connected, a social fact that was recognized early on by Max Weber. It's also important to go beyond the individual level and critically analyze what might be called collective utopias of aspiration, Marxist, Pentecostal, free market, or otherwise. And you have to see this as a juxtaposition of equal, in a way, equal aspirations, the free market one, the Pentecostal one, and the Marxist one, that characterize urban politics by engaging with the shifting realities on the ground that often contradict these utopian visions. In my view, it's not the global versus the national or the political versus the economic or any other such dichotomy that should frame our study. Most important is to step away from the secularist modernism that still dominates urban studies. I mean, I have now, because I had this project, been reading a lot of urban studies. Yeah, there's no religion in that whatsoever. I mean, as if there is no religion in cities. If one wants to offer an alternative to the focus on Western cities in urban theory as well as to Marxist globalism, one needs to look squarely at perhaps the most important form of globalization that is not state engineered, religious movements. The neglect of this important aspect of the urban landscape demonstrates the radically secular perspective or blindness of urban theorists. While urban theorists are vaguely aware that cathedrals and churches are the spectacular skyscrapers of the past, they are happy to leave them to historians, as indeed, things of the past. To anthropologists, they leave what they consider to be the passing interest in religious bonds that characterize the life of first-generation immigrants. That the trope of passing and past belongs squarely to the old dreams of secular modernism has not been fully realized by most urban theorists. Even in the recently emerging interest in the affective register of cities, in spatialities of feeling, as championed by Nigel Thrift and others, there is no reference to religion or to the mix of secularism and religion in what Bella and his colleagues have eloquently called habits of the heart. And if one goes outside of the Euro-American space, ignoring religious spatiality, would be immediately absurd, even in the sanitized urban spaces of China. What often escapes from both sight and analysis is the nature of public life in cities, but does not only feature shopping malls, bazaars, cinemas, but also temples, churches, and shrines, with a number of ancillary charitable and other activities. Global cities are providing social material for the innovation of religious institutions and for aspirations and experiments, partly because they exhibit unexpected combinations of media images and demographic shifts. Seoul is a wonderful example for that, of course. If you have been, when you go to Seoul, basically, and you arrive at late in the afternoon, and you go to your hotel, you open the curtains, you see everywhere these red crosses. This city is completely Christianized. It's not that it is Christian or something, but it is Christianized in its spatial imagery. These global cities sometimes seem highly volatile in their ability to act as platforms for the broadcasting of political and religious aspirations. They can be prone to social unrest, riots, rumors, and epidemics of social fear. At the same time, they also appear to generate surprising new solidarities, new visions of the good life, and new ideas about friendship and conviviality. One of the most tenacious misunderstandings of cities, therefore, is that they are modern and therefore secular. A leading French Catholic sociologist, Gabriel Lebrun, writes in the 1950s that, and I quote, "I myself am convinced that of 100 rural people that come to live in Paris, around 90 stop practicing their religion when they get out of Gare Montparnasse," unquote. But the great historical religions, in fact, they're all urban. Moreover, cities in Asia like Bangkok or Beijing were centers of religious cosmologies and are, to some extent, still, of course, of a modern religious cosmology. Chinese capital Beijing, for instance, has been for centuries the cosmic center of China, organized around feng shui principles. When the communists took over, Mao Zedong personally decided to locate the government in the old city, making use of this ancient conception of the cosmic center, but at the same time destroying the old buildings. We see here a form of iconoclasm that is quite common, namely the appropriation of a sacred place, destroying the previous religion, and appropriating its sacred power for the new religion. And I think part of what communism has been doing is, of course, is exactly that. Tiananmen had to be transformed from an insulated imperial quarter into an open space for political activity. However, open only in a spatial sense, not in the sense of Habermas's Öffentlichkeit. It became the square where the party showed its ideological centrality in the architecture, as well as in the huge Mao portrait that dominates the square and in its regular manifestations, such as the party congress and the Great Hall of the People, but also the space for challenging that hegemony in 1989. With the transformation of Tiananmen into a huge public square with the possibility of containing 600,000 people, Mao created a space for the demonstration of party's power. But occasionally the party's power is misunderstood by the Chinese as the people's power. Till today, such mistakes are bloodily repressed. But the party lives in constant fear of the spread of a revolutionary fervor to its squares. Not only were the 1989 Tiananmen Square demands for democracy violently repressed, but also the 1999 Zhongnanhai demonstration by the religious Falun Gong in the center of Beijing. Secularism is a state-led project of repression and transformation in China and in other communist societies that cannot be understood as a process of secularization. The relatively recent Western European experience of simultaneous urbanization and unchurching, which is the subject of secularization theory, is a particular historical phenomenon, uneven and not linear, and not causally connected to industrialization. Social scientists like Ernest Gellner and Brian Wilson, to take only a few examples, have mistaken this singular historical, this provincial, you may say, historical experience for a universal model of modernization and secularization. This is the more surprising in light of the fact that the European experience is radically different from the US experience of a religious diverse society in which migrants to the city, and especially transnational immigrants, use religion to carve out a space for themselves. Sometimes such experience has also been ignored by American sociologists. For instance, the famous Chicago School of Urban Studies of the 1930s has been able to ethnographically study urban black communities without paying attention to the role of black churches. To ignore such an overwhelming evidence of social facts must have its origin in the secular ideology of social scientists. The idea that religion can be urban, modern, innovative, and creative instead of rural, traditional, conservative, and repressive, and that if modern, it does not have to be fundamentalist, has only won ground in the last two decades, but hardly within urban studies. It's important not to reify religion, but to include it in a range of urban aspirations. So I think that is really quite important, that the sharp distinction between religiosity and ethnicity and class, one has to be very careful with that. As I have argued at some length elsewhere, religion in its modern universal sense, all people everywhere have religion, is a 19th century concept with a deeper genealogy in Western thought, which is spread across the globe. In the interactional history between the West and Asia, it belongs to a syntagmatic chain of religion, magic, secularity, spirituality. So religion, magic, secularity, and spirituality belong to each other. These terms do not possess stable meanings independently from one another, and thus cannot be simply defined separately. They emerge historically together, imply one another, and function as nodes within a shifting field of power. It is therefore not possible to see the city as secular or religious, because it is both at the same time, and it is magical as well as spiritual. In Vasily Kandinsky's view, modern art is spiritual, and it emerges in Paris, Berlin, Vienna, and Moscow. Cinema is an urban phenomenon originating in Hollywood, Bollywood, Hong Kong, and Shanghai. It is the magic of the cinema that brings the protagonist of John Updike's novel In the Beauty of the Lilies to start doubting his faith. So a really interesting competition between cinema, the rise of cinema, and religion. Cinema may be a product of the devil out to destroy religion, as I was brought up to think, as a strict Calvinist in the Netherlands. But it produces this by providing fantasies that God has forbidden. This is an instance of the long anti-magic tradition of Protestantism that is alert to the magical possibilities of the Wizard of Oz, of Blade Runner, and of Shaolin movies, as well as Indian mythologicals. In Shanghai, the modern is officially secular, and it's very difficult to find religion in Shanghai. That is not only the perspective of the authorities, but also of major cultural theorists like Liu Ufan Li, who in his classic Shanghai Modern, or On Interbellum Shanghai, manages to omit any reference to the importance of Shanghai in Buddhist and Taoist modernism. So it's as if it doesn't exist. This is just weird. And this is not because of the strict separation of secular and religious spheres, because you can see in the rise of movies in the 1920s in Shanghai an enormous interest in the connection between, magical performances and martial arts, which are basically the precursor of the later Hong Kong martial art movies. It is not that separation. The reason is the same as the reason that brought this genre of martial arts magic spirit films to an end. The government forbade the showing of this popular genre that fed on the superstition of the masses. Its neglect in cultural history is part of a common intellectual denigration of the religious as anti-scientific and thus retrograde in China. And in architectural history, there's very little sense of the huge destruction of temples and ancestral halls that were the centers of a vibrant religious life in the 1930s. The magic of modernity can not only be found in the cinema, but also in the glittering displays of new consumption palaces, the department stores and today's malls. Places like Singapore, Bangkok and Shanghai, with Mumbai, Bangalore and Hanoi following at some distance, try to define themselves by these spaces of concentrated consumption. So of course the most developed in Singapore. These are also spaces that allow one, as the Romans had it, to see and be seen. They are at the same time highly regulated spaces that stand in some contrast with the unregulated heat and noise, renau in Chinese, of the wet markets in Singapore or the Crawford market in Mumbai. While it is high-end fashion that is sold in the department store, it is the items of health and male potency that are for sale in the open markets. These constitute different strategies of magical self-enhancement that we hardly ever connect to each other in our analysis, although those who shop in the malls also frequent the open markets. Moreover, the nature of crowding in these different spaces seems to create a variety of sensorial experiences and effervescences that escape easy mapping in purely secular terms. Henry James called London a city of dreadful delights, a phrase that beautifully captures the ambivalence of desire and fear that is produced by the city. The complaints about the rudeness of the inhabitants of New York, Paris, Berlin, Shanghai, Amsterdam are easily coupled with a desire to be with the young and uninhibited. The spaces that need to be avoided out of racial or sexual fear at the same time exert powerful attraction. As such, the city is the fulcrum of deep moralizations about extreme possibilities and ambitions. Intellectuals have played a significant role in reforming or rejecting and generally ideologizing traditions as either essentially capable of adjusting to modernity or of resisting modernity. These intellectuals tend to be located in cities where universities are created and the interaction with Western ideas is more intense. While the debate about modernity takes primarily place among intellectuals, secular and religious, in newspapers and in magazines and in other media, the city is also the meeting ground of various populations that have hardly been in touch with each other, which makes the need for self-identification and connection quite important. This can be done through churches, temples, shrines, or storefront places of worship. The city, therefore, is at these various levels a theater of religious innovation. Although innovation can imply a new conservatism, it's often underestimated how innovative forms of conservatism, of explicit moral strictness, and of rejection of immorality are. So this whole debate which we have in Europe about, say, veiling and so on is a very good example of that. It's very innovative practices. There's a materiality and performativity in city life, such as in modes of public transport, that requires everyday tactics of self-presentation. Therefore, I propose to use religion not as a thing that can be easily distinguished from the flow of social life in cities, but as a lens through which one can acquire a better view of what urban aspirations are, regardless of whether they are called secular or religious. It's precisely global cities that experience large-scale immigration and related innovative patterns of religiosity, often fueled by transnational flows of ideas and people. Asia, obviously, is a particular challenge for using religion as a lens to understand the urban. On the one hand, one has to counter the notion that Asian modernity is unfinished, that Asians are religious because they are not yet secularized. This view is really tenacious and derives from a real misunderstanding about the secularity of the West. China is often seen as an exception to this picture of religious Asia, Japan too. But the secular nature of public life in Shanghai is not the result of the city's successful modernization and secularization, but simply of political power. you cannot perform religiously in Shanghai or on the streets of Beijing. So basically all public manifestations of religion are being pushed into the private. Similarly, I would argue, the religious nature, which is in your face, of Bangkok is not a given, but likewise the result of political power. There's a very interesting, obviously, a very interesting connection between royal power, nationalism, and religion in Bangkok. What is deemed religious or secular is determined in a political process that uses the city as a platform for national aspirations. So in that sense, the city is really quite important because it's really a platform where everyone comes together to show to the others what they want. While the study of Asia is indispensable for any comparative social science, it should be clear that the idea of Asia is as problematic as that of Europe. Asian societies and cities form a fuzzy set that can provide the basis of comparisons within the region and with the West. For our purposes, comparison should not primarily be seen in terms of comparing societies or events or institutional arrangements across society, but as a reflection on our conceptual framework, as well as on the history of interactions that have constituted our object of study. So it's both comparison is both a reflection on our conceptual framework as on the object that has been formed through a series of interactions. Such critical reflection may lead to the argument that Asian cities should be understood in their own terms and cannot be understood in Western terms. However, Indian and Chinese realities have to be interpreted and translated in relation to social science scholarship that has historically originated in the West. Moreover, such translations and interpretations are part of a long history of interactions with the West. The field of comparison has been widely democratized by modern media, so that everyday realities of the immediate and distant societies are thoroughly mediated and interconnected. Everyone in the US probably sees these things in Paris happening and say, oh my goodness, these friends are having a problem. Very different from the problem that we have here. And we Europeans look at Ferguson and say, oh, these Americans, they have all these problems. So you do it constantly, this kind of comparative view, trying to figure out what is the difference between what your problems are and those problems are. Very little understanding of how these problems are in fact very connected. Democracy, civil society, public sphere, urbanity, civility, religiosity are all concepts within a particular tradition of modernity that creates the discursive space in which we engage our studies. Comparison is thus not a relatively simple juxtaposition and comparison of two or more different societies, but a complex reflection on the network of concepts that both underlie our study of society as well as on the formation of those societies themselves. In that sense, it's always a double act of reflection. For instance, one can hardly ignore the origins of psychoanalysis in Fender Schaeckle of Vienna when attempting to give an account of the emergence of new technologies of the self in urban Asia. I had once a discussion with the party chief of Shanghai, but for some reason, in a kind of public occasion, and later he was arrested for corruption, which had nothing to do with it. But, and he said, well, how can the social sciences be used for managing and governing a big city, a huge city, more than 20 million people, as Shanghai? And I said, well, and he was thinking that they had to more mind their own traditions, the Chinese way of dealing with these problems. But I said, you are leader of the Communist Party. Where do you think communism comes from? And so the whole sense that this is already in a totally mediated space is not foregrounded very much. The language in which we describe Asian urbanity is always already part of an earlier conversation. And I would like to start with this, a new conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for such a